Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's Week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, it's not often that a 0-0 draw provides the sort of talking points that the stalemate in Copenhagen did, especially if you forget everything that happened in the second half and focus solely on the first 45 minutes. We'll get into that on today's Blue Moon podcast, along with more on the Premier League situation as Manchester City produced yet another dominant win. Look at the scoreline, and it seemed a really simple afternoon against Southampton, but this was impressive for different reasons. City's unbeaten record faces its next test on Sunday too as Pep Guardiola takes his side to Anfield. We'll get a Liverpool perspective on the game a bit later on, but let's be honest, it feels like City have a great opportunity to take 3 points from Merseyside and a ground that they often find life very difficult at. We'll also have something for fans of old City goals too. The man behind the Retro City Goals Instagram account will be on the show, talking about the great and the good of City teams of years gone by, finding the net in all manner of circumstances. So let's get going. I'm David Mooney. Joining me for this one, I've got two City fans. We start with Bob Toole.
Hi Mooney, how are you?
Not too bad, thanks mate. And Ali Fogg.
Hi there. Hi, everyone.
Ali, been a while since you've been on. How are you? Well? Are you keeping well?
I am keeping well. A little bit chilly today because I'm trying hard not to put the heating on as much as I would have done in previous years. So I've been sitting in a Blue City beanie cap trying to keep the heat in my head.
We like that. We do like that. Bob, you well?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I've got the week off work this week, so that's very nice just to sort of slow down a bit and... Well, I was going to say enjoy the football. Well, yeah. Literally chilling out.
Yeah. You're going to say enjoy the football, but...
Yeah, but then that game happened the other night.
Oh, of course.
Which was terrible, wasn't it? So, which we're going to talk about, obviously. But yeah.
Well, let's get into that. We'll start with Rodri's disallowed goal. Because here's the ruling, basically, that I think has been made. I don't think this has been disallowed because of an accidental handball, because that can only disallow the goal if it's handball by the scorer. And in this case, it went from Mahrez to Alvarez to Rodri. That means that the decision was a deliberate handball by Mahrez, who passed to Alvarez. Likely given, Ali, because Mahrez's arm moved towards the ball. With all that in mind, what do you make of it?
What do I make of it? I'm going to get a little bit... I'm going to swap my blue beanie hat for a tinfoil one. My best explanation of what happened is that the referee and the VAR team actually forgot the rules. Initially, they ruled it out because they thought any handball in the lead-up to a goal disallowed it, which was the rule until for a couple of years until 2021. And then when they realized they'd messed up, suddenly the story changed to it had to be a deliberate handball. It clearly was not an intentional handball. I think Mahrez couldn't move his arm out of the way because of the two players around him. I think they were forcing his arm forward onto the ball. I don't see any way he really could have been expected to get his arm out of the way. And the whole thing is a farce, is how I stand on it. I really think we've got to the position where the rules change in so many subtle but important ways so often that players don't know what the rules are, referees don't know what the rules are, managers don't know what the rules are, and probably most importantly of all, fans don't know what the rules are. So when you're watching a game, you cannot properly understand what is happening. And that is a nonsense. I actually don't really, well, tinfoil-hatted conspiracy theories aside, I don't blame the officials too much. I blame the people that write these ever increasingly complicated laws and interpretations of laws, which have the effect of becoming so complicated that any mistake can be explained away. Just an interpretation.
It's almost, in many ways, it's almost kind of unintended consequences, isn't it? The number of times where we've had to fix it because something's happened that we need to be able to explain. Yeah.
That's exactly. It's like it's like nailing on another panel to the car that you've built from scratch and hoping that it'll suddenly drive in a straight line now. And it just every time it gets worse and worse and worse. And it just is a farce. The only thing I will say in kind of compensation or whatever the word is if we're going to have a Champions League game where everything goes comically wrong. Then at least it was one where it didn't matter too much, and particularly after the result later, it mattered even less. But comedy abounds.
Yeah, I mean the thing is, Bob. As I say, like it's been deemed deliberate because Mahrez's arm moved towards the ball. Like it's almost like it's in his running pattern anyway. Like your arm is always going to move in that direction. So it can't just be as simple as handball is when you're like a deliberate handball is when your arm moves towards the ball, especially if the ball's dropping from a height that you can't really see because there are two players around you.
Yeah, I mean it's such a hard thing to rule on, I think, because deliberate, you sort of get into the realms of trying to read somebody's mind as to whether they intentionally touch the ball or not, unless they've like stuck their arm out like a goalkeeper would to save a shot. How can you possibly say it's deliberate? And in this particular case, Mahrez was under pressure from two other players. The ball was dropping out of the sky. The trajectory of the ball barely changed once he actually did touch it with his arm. So how could they possibly say it's deliberate? It's beyond me.
Well, this is the other thing. Like if none of the Copenhagen players realised or appealed, and none of the City players realised and were sheepish about it, like should it be penalised?
I mean, I don't. It's kind of irrelevant, I think, whether the players appeal or not, because ultimately the referee's there to enforce the rules, whether players are aware of them or see something or not. So I don't think that really plays into it. But what does annoy me is whenever the referee's called to go and look at the monitor on the side of the pitch, everybody just knows the original decision is going to get overturned. I'm not sure I've ever seen one where the referee's gone to the side of the pitch, looked at it, and then just stuck to the original decision. So it's almost just like for show, which really gets me, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm really not sure that whether the Copenhagen players saw it or not matters, really.
Because that also, Bob, brings me on to the City penalty, because, again, none of the City players saw it. None of the Copenhagen players saw it. The only people that saw it were the VAR team. And, I mean, again, I kind of think that one's a bit harsh, because it looks like it hits him above the we're told about this T-shirt line on the arm that kind of comes from the armpit. Looks like it hits him above that.
Yeah, I mean, if you compare it to the famous Rodri handball against Everton, like
he didn't handle it. He can't, we came to the conclusion that he didn't handle it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I must admit, when I was watching the game live, I wasn't clear on what the handball rules are. But I was just glad we got a penalty because of the feeling aggrieved about the Mahrez one. But yeah, I mean, had it been against us, I would have been pretty annoyed about it because it just was. It was so inconsequential to the general pattern of play anyway. It didn't really affect what happened. And if memory serves correctly, it took ages for the VAR to even sort of mention it. It was all just a bit of a farce, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then finally, Ali, that brings us on to the red card. This one seems to be the only one where we can all go around and go, yeah, that was probably fair enough, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. I would just add something to what Bob said about the penalty we got given, though, which of my sympathy was slightly curtailed by the fact that the offending player, the one who committed the handball, he committed the handball because he had his hand on the shirt of one of the City players and he was pushing him away in a way that's actually a foul itself. And if he hadn't been grabbing the shirt of a City player, then he wouldn't have handled the ball. So that kind of that diminished my sympathy I might have had for them otherwise. But as Bob said, it didn't count for anything in the end. But the red card now, I think the referee, because it was yet another one, the referee didn't give it at the time, did he? He got called by VAR.
Yeah, that worries me slightly, because
the only thing that I can see in that is, particularly if you'd seen it from the referee's side, which was the other side of the cameras, the Copenhagen player dragged his left foot in a quite egregious and spectacular way in order to bring himself down. So right. he felt the arms were being linked, and you know, he was being held back, you know, with kind of quite a subtle link of arms. But then he made sure the referee saw, with what was, by the rules of the game, a fairly blatant bit of simulation. He fell over because he dragged his own left foot, not because he was pulled over by, by Gomez.
What I was going to say was my understanding of the VAR protocol is that the referee looks at the incident and describes what he's seen to the VAR, and the VAR will then say, actually, no, that's not what's happened, or that is what's happened. And so I couldn't come to terms with what the referee could possibly have said to the VAR that would make the VAR say, well, actually, something entirely different has happened. Come and have a look at it. So if it looks like he's simulated from the other side, then
indeed. And of course, the other thing to blow my own theory out of the water, if he did think that was the explanation for why he fell over, he should have been booking the Copenhagen player for simulation. Because you know, if that's what he thought had happened, that's how he should have acted. But of course, we know that very often players do simulate and aren't booked, even when the referee knows that's full well what they're doing. It has to be above a certain bar of blatant taking the mickey before you ever get a yellow card for that.
But just on Gomez, Bob, as well, I don't think we should let this incident kind of blot his copybook, because I think he's had a reasonable start to life at City beyond this.
Yeah, I think he's looked pretty tidy. If you compare him to Zinchenko, who he's kind of replaced, I would say, he doesn't look a huge amount different, but he looks a bit better going forward. So a bit more pacey and direct in an attacking sense. So yeah, I'm pretty pleased with him. And to be honest, like I wouldn't mind seeing him start against Liverpool in spite of this red card. So I'm really chuffed with him.
Yeah, just on Mahrez as well, Bob. How do you think he will be doing right now? Given that obviously he was the reason why the goal was disallowed. We don't really put too much blame on him for that, but you know he'll be thinking about that. He then went on and missed the penalty, and then when City had a man sent off and they wanted to bring a defender on, he was the player that got subbed. I'm just a bit worried that he's not going to be in the right frame of mind for a while.
Yeah, it's difficult to call because Pep didn't play him. Was it the last season where Algeria didn't qualify for the World Cup and he just basically said he wasn't in the right frame of mind to play, which from the outside, you can't really account for those kind of things. But obviously, as you know, Pep will know his players and sort of take that into account. So I've always thought doesn't seem to be a particularly like sensitive guy in that sense, but seemingly he is. So yeah, it is maybe the case that he is a bit sort of short on confidence, and then what happened on Tuesday may play into that, because he's had a bit of a slow start, hasn't he, really? But then he did quite well against Southampton, and yeah, he seemed to start all right against Copenhagen, was quite involved in a lot of the play, so yeah, it's a hard one to call, but I mean, I don't think he'll start against Liverpool anyway, just because his form's not as good as the other forward players. So whether he takes that to heart, I'm not too sure, but it's possible, I think.
Yeah, Ali, it has been a slow start to the season. In terms of kind of player mentality, it's one thing that we don't often think about. But I think Mahrez this season might be an example of what can happen when you get in the wrong frame of mind.
It can do. I mean, I would say, first of all, of everything Mahrez has done or been criticised for, I don't blame him at all for the handball for the Rodrigo or non-goal, and I don't really blame him for missing the penalty. It wasn't the best penalty, but if you step up and you're the penalty taker, you know, Mahrez is probably a 10 out of 12 penalty taker, and he's really good at them. And unless you're Yaya Toure, even the best penalty takers do miss sometimes. And, you know, that's, you know, the rub of the green.
What I am much more concerned about with Mahrez is when you compare him to the other players who sometimes play in his position on the right wing, or when you compare to what the rest of the team is doing and the potential of our other players. I don't think he is fitting into the tactical formations and the team play that we are now using in order to get the ball basically to Erling Haaland to score a goal. You see it when Phil Foden is playing on the right. He and Kevin De Bruyne have repeatedly, it must have happened like 4, 5, 6 times this season, they've pulled off these little 1-2s and 1-2-3s, which then release the ball into the middle for Haaland, and he taps it in and scores a goal. It looks very instinctive. It looks very straightforward, and that's because KDB and Phil Foden are operating at such high levels. When you see Mahrez in the same position, Kevin will make the run outside the fullback, waiting for Mahrez to slide the ball into him the way Phil Foden does, and Mahrez cuts inside and shoots and misses. And that keeps happening again and again and again. And that's where my concerns are with Mahrez. It's not really about individual specific mistakes or even about his ball control or his energy, all of which can be criticised. I'm not sure he's quite got his head around the way our team plays now. And that's my concern. Having said that, I also value Riyad Mahrez as an incredibly talented and valuable member of our squad. And I would be fully supportive if Pep was making the decision that in order to get Mahrez into the place he wants him to be and performing at the levels he needs from him, the solution to that is to keep picking him again and again and again until he gets it. That, that works for me, and I'm okay with that. I'm not calling for Mahrez to be dropped. I'm happy to trust Pep on that. But I don't think we should be under any illusions that Mahrez is in the best form of his life. He clearly isn't.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Southampton game as well, because Bob, I thought, in many ways, like I said in the intro, it looks a really comfortable City win. And, you look at the scoreline and say, oh, 4-0, City just strolled it. But I don't think they did. I think City had to be really, really good to win that game, because Southampton were pressing high. They were really trying to cause City problems at the back. How impressed were you with the way that City dealt with that?
Yeah, pretty impressed. I mean, I remember saying after about 10 minutes of the game to Casey, who I sit next to at the ground, that Southampton have given us much more of a game than United ever did the week before. And I guess that's a bit of it's a bit of an insult to Southampton, really, because United were woeful. But yeah, I mean, I was worried about the game beforehand because of what they did to us last year. We found it so hard to beat them. But I think we're on a little bit of a different level this year. And obviously the Haaland factor, it just makes such a huge difference, doesn't it? I mean, he's just so dangerous that he occupies several defenders at once, which just makes everybody else's job even easier.
Just more space, isn't there? Yeah,
exactly. And I guess also, given we went into that game off the back of the United game and also winning in midweek in the Champions League really comfortably, the confidence was really, really high. So, it was really impressive. Like you said, it did seem comfortable in the end. But first half particularly, I don't think it was a particularly comfortable game. We had to work really, really hard for it. So, yeah, it was excellent.
Yeah, Ali, the system that Southampton played got them 2 draws last season. So you're not surprised that they came and tried to do it again. What was the difference, do you think, this year beyond the fact that Haaland was up top?
I think there's one really big difference, which is that the games over the last couple of seasons, they've had Romelu, who's no longer there, and also Ward-Prowse being on really quite exceptional form when he's played us in the last game or the one before that. So they were holding the centre of midfield in a way that they really didn't last week. Of course, it's a real shame that Labia is injured and wasn't playing, because I think he was the player that came in to do that job for Southampton, and they didn't have that. And we did just kind of breeze through the middle of their midfield anytime we wanted to. I will say, We made it quite hard work. It was a slightly strange game in that we played quite well, but didn't get goals. And Haaland actually missed a couple of, by his standard, sitters, which, you know, had all the chances that came Haaland's way landed in the back of the net, we'd have been looking at a much higher score much earlier, and we wouldn't even be having this conversation about, you know, any downsides or reservations. But yeah, I think Southampton are basically just not the same team that they were a year or two ago. They're really struggling this year, and I'm guessing that the big hole in their middle of their midfield is a large part of the reason why.
Yeah. Bernardo was quietly brilliant, I thought, Bob. You know, Cancelo was getting all the headlines for the way he played. Obviously, the forward players were getting the headlines as well for the goals they scored. But Bernardo dropping in to get the ball off Rodri really helped City get forward, I thought. He, for someone who doesn't really want to be in Manchester, he's doing all right in Manchester, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. He looks really at home in central midfield as well. There was one point in the second half where he was picking up the ball from deep position, and I was just looked at him and thought, is he really happy in that position? And I thought for a moment, like, he'd maybe be happier playing on the wing or something like that. But then I just thought, no, he's just so good at what he does in the middle. Like, he's like a metronome, isn't he? And I know Sam Lee talks a lot about Pep's obsession with that pauser, like keeping things moving. He'll be able to articulate it much better than I ever will, but Bernardo fills that role perfectly, and I know Gundogan is the other guy in the team that really does that since David Silva left. So having two options now that just do that role so well is like ideal, really, because we can just rotate Bernardo and Gundogan as we see fit. But yeah, he's so sort of tenacious, and he just doesn't ever stop. I mean, there's always the famous example, isn't there, a few seasons ago in the 2-1 against Liverpool in the January, where he like covered about 13 kilometres in one match. And that's kind of sums him up when he plays in the middle. He's everywhere, and he presses constantly. And obviously he's just got a great attacking ability to find really good passes. And occasionally he's got a really good shot on him. So
yeah,
he's really good in the middle, I think.
Did you see the viral video of him this week, Ali?
I don't think I did. What was that?
He's leaning up against the front door, and somebody comes over to him and just kind of like says, Bernardo Silva, and he's like, my friend, what are you doing? And then agrees to take a picture with him. But it just looks like the shadiest man in Manchester leaning up against his door. Fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've said this before, possibly in this pod, but I think one of the most iconic images of Manchester City over the last, you know, the Pep Guardiola era, is Bernardo standing in his shabby anorak with his strip tied round his waist and a cup of tea in his hand when the Liverpool Guard of Honour was supposed to be happening. And I would very happily put a statue to Bernardo Silva somewhere outside the Etihad in that exact pose with a cup of tea in one hand and a bottle of water in the other.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Just quickly on Akanji as well, Ali, because he was at right back. He made it a he was nominally at right back because he made it practically a back three, so that can Kinsella could go and be a winger. Given City's options and injuries at the moment, do you think we'll see a bit more of that in the coming weeks?
I presume it's likely since we have so few other options available to us. And he's what a revelation he has been. I mean, I knew we all trusted the City backroom team when they brought him in and reckoned he could do a job. And considering we bought him for you know price of a bag of chips and a bottle of Imto, he has just been absolutely phenomenal. One thing I noticed really early on, like in his first game or two, when Cancelo was playing on the right, so nominally as right back, but would of course be playing in basically in Kevin De Bruyne's position somewhere, you know, advanced of the number eight. Akanji just drifted over so easily, so naturally towards the right wing. I mean, at times he almost had chalk in his boots and he was just covering that side of the pitch in a way that, Kyle Walker, prior to this season when he was persuaded to start overlapping and coming inside. Kyle Walker used to just effortlessly control his whole quarter of the pitch, so that anything that came into his quarter, he would mop it up and sweep it away and solve the problem. Akanji is now doing that job really well.
Yeah.
Whether he is nominally a centre-back playing on the right or whether he is officially a right-back doesn't actually make a huge amount of difference to me. Yeah. You know, the way we use full-backs, I think we need to develop a new language to describe the kind of position that Cancelo plays, because I'm not even sure he's a defender in any meaningful sense anymore. But Akanji very much is, and he's an absolutely exceptional defender, and he's really is one of the, you know, obviously on a much less spectacular scale to Haaland, but Akanji is one of the success stories of the season. He's been an absolute revelation.
Yeah, so what Guardiola does to us, make us not have the words to describe what he's doing with the team.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The man defies the English language. Let's finish the first part of the show on Haaland, Bob. Again, he got his goal, low cross, smashed into the net. That, it feels like that is going to be the typical Haaland goal, doesn't it? You know, he finds himself in the right place in the box and he just wellies it as hard as he can.
Well, I mean, he scores so many, it will be one of several types of goals he scores, I imagine, because he's already scored quite a good variety already. But I mean, that goal against Southampton, though, we've seen so many times over the years under Pep, that kind of pretty much precise pattern of play.
It's only the names that change, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And he's obviously just got that ability to be there at the right place at the right time, which, you know, the last couple of seasons when we've not really had a proper out and out number nine, it's sometimes we'd do that move and there'd just be nobody there or someone just a couple of yards away. But he just seems to know where to be all the time, which is just incredible. So I think we will see that goal a lot, and we already have. But then you see all manner of other types of goals, like some of the goals he's got, I think the hat-trick against Forest, they were just really kind of scruffy goals that we just never really scored last season. So there's all manner of types, but the only one he's kind of missing, I think, so far is like a long-range screamer. So I think the closest he got was the Wolves goal. But
it's not a screamer, that, is it? Yeah,
no. Exactly.
Definitely doesn't count as a screamer. Ali, just on his relationship with the other forward players, I'm interested what you think of how City have changed with Haaland, because even at the start of the season, it felt like they were trying to get the ball to him really, really quickly. And now it seems like they're a lot more patient with getting it there. And especially Foden and De Bruyne seem to know when the right time is to slide it into him.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And it's not at all surprising. One of the things I think we always need to remember is that City players play with such elegance and skill, and they make it look so easy, particularly when we're playing possession football. It looks as if everything is just coming like, you know, these players were born to it. It's completely intuitive and instinctive. The reality is, It's not intuitive. It's not instinctive. It's the product of hundreds or thousands of hours of individual technical coaching and team formation drills and practice. And when you are used to players, your teammates being in a position, or a particular position on the pitch, you can turn and you can play blind to a, play into an area and know that your teammate will be there. When you fundamentally change the shape in which you play, in the way we have this year, the formation of all 11 players on our pitch is significantly different now. Those intuitive, instinctive decisions where you just turn and you play a ball behind you to where you know a player is going to be, it takes time for that to settle in and for the players to be where you expect them to be. And what we're seeing, I think, almost with every week that goes by, is the ease and the naturalness with which our creative players are building up formations with each other and then releasing Haaland. The classic example is De Bruyne playing to Phil Foden, who then plays a ball around the opposing fullback, which Kevin De Bruyne runs onto and then pulls back to Haaland, who's in the middle to tap it in. I mentioned it before, we've seen that goal several times now. And the more we do it, the easier and more naturally it will begin to look. And I've absolutely no idea that, no doubt that by the time we get to next March, April, May, all of that teamwork will look so much more easy and, believe it or not, be so much more devastating at the end of the season than it is now, because we are still learning. Our players are still learning how to play in this new formation, and that's entirely understandable and absolutely fine.
Yeah. Just one last thing on Haaland, Bob. I just want to get your thoughts on the release clause story this week, because it's been going round and round and round. The situation, as we can kind of glean, this is generally from Paul Byas at The Athletic, that there is a release clause in Haaland's contract, but it only activates in the summer of 2024. It's for €200 million, or around about £175.5 million. It'll decrease every year after 2024. No Premier League team can trigger that clause anyway, and there's no clause for any specific team, so there's no different details for example, Real Madrid or PSG or anybody like that. It is just €200 million from the summer of 2024. What are your feelings on it all? Because for me, it's just a formalization of the policy that City have anyway. If you want to leave, then you can leave. Just bring us an offer.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's fine, but then on the other hand, I'm a little bit annoyed about it, because I kind of like the idea of us just being able to hold people to ransom and just say whatever we want to scare them away. So it's a little bit annoying in that sense, because there's about three clubs, you'd probably say, that would be able to trigger that release clause. But as you and your colleagues on the Athletic podcast were saying, it's not just the clause, it's everything else, the whole package, the agents' fees and all the everything else that goes into a huge transfer like that. So it's going to be way more than 200 million. So it is going to make it incredibly difficult for anybody to pull that off. But I guess it is possible. So that does worry me a little bit. But on the other hand, like you say, it's a formalization of the kind of policy we do anyway. So it's not that much of a bigger deal.
Honestly, mate, my gut is don't worry about it. Nobody's triggering that clause. Don't worry about it.
Well, also, I just don't want to really get worried about something like that, because it's just, a couple of months into having Haaland. So let's just enjoy it whilst we've got it, because it's amazing. So.
The only trigger that actually matters is Haaland wanting to leave. If Erling Haaland is happy and scoring goals and having a great time at City, as all the indications are now he is doing, it's inconceivable why he would want to go to anywhere else. It's not even like he's got the defence of being a sun-loving Latin type who's missing the weather. He's a bloody Norwegian. He grew up in, born in Leeds and grew up in Manchester. He can cope with the weather too. Unless he makes the terrible mistake of getting himself an Italian supermodel wife who doesn't like the food, it's really hard to imagine why he would ever want to leave.
Yeah, I love the idea that he'd turn around to City and say, actually, I want to leave because I want to go back to somewhere where it doesn't get dark at night. All right, that's fine. Off you go. Right. Well, let's move our attention to Liverpool and Anfield on Sunday. Let's begin by getting a Liverpool perspective on this weekend's match. I've been speaking to Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap to get a view of what the mood is like at Anfield at the moment.
I felt Liverpool would bounce into this season, and instead they've done whatever the opposite of bouncing is, squashed their way into the season, to be honest with you. I think it's become one of those things that doesn't have one answer, you know, and I think that a number of Liverpool supporters, as football supporters, are wanted to do, would like there to be one answer. But I think there's a number of factors sort of all at play simultaneously. Within that, you know, I think that the toll of everything, really. Liverpool haven't finished a season under Jurgen Klopp where the final game hasn't mattered. They've only really, well, with the exception of the COVID, of the season where we win the league and then it's interrupted by COVID, every other season the final games had a great deal riding on it all the way through. And I think that's played a part, that's added its burden as well. But across the board, really, Liverpool ultimately have just been disappointing. I think there's circumstances around that. I think there's conversations to be had around, you know, what Liverpool do or don't do in the transfer market these days. I think there's a lot of little bits and pieces that make up this situation that we found ourselves in. And therefore, that's complicated because a lot of little bits and pieces do not lend themselves nicely to being able to say, well, if you just do this, this and this, everything will be fixed.
Yeah, I wondered how much of the problems that you've been having this season are simply that it's difficult to say one, like there's one reason or another reason, but how much of it has been losing Sadio Mane?
I think it's not helped, and because I think there's something that Sadio, whether he played left wing or played centre forward for Liverpool, was really good at, was helping Liverpool get 50 yards up the pitch. And I think we've lost that to a slight extent, and I think that also, we also didn't have Diogo Jota at the start of the campaign either. He had an interrupted pre-season. So ultimately, I think we tend to think in a footballing sense that if one attacker moves out at one point of the season and another one comes in, they're the direct replacements. But I don't think Darwin Nunez is the replacement for Sadio Mane. I think the replacement for Sadio Mane is a combination of Luis Diaz and Diogo Jota. And we didn't have Jota at the start of the campaign. So I think that hasn't helped. Simultaneously, I think there are other factors in play. I think that, in a really strange way, Virgil van Dijk has started this season the way I expected him to start last season after the extended injury layoff. I think he's not quite been entirely himself. And that's even stranger when you think that the second half of last season, he did look back to his best. He feels now like he, you know, maybe there is some sort of injury hangover there, or maybe it's that he's just getting a bit more exposed, or maybe it's a bit of both. I think within the idea of him being a bit more exposed, I think that Fabinho was already finding, I think he's not very good constructively, Fabinho, from March to May last season, to the point that, this is in hindsight, I was saying I didn't want him to start the Champions League final in Paris. I wanted to go with Henderson, Thiago and Keita as the midfield three, because Fabinho had a recent injury, but he just began to look really fatigued, like a lad who's just played too much football for too long, and that's continued into this season as well. And then on top of that, you know, I don't think that Henderson started the season putting really good 90s together. I think the issue has been I think Jordan's looked himself for extended periods, but then had a dip for a period of time in the game, and he might well have found his way back, but then he's found that a little bit difficult. Thiago got injured first game away at Fulham. Within there, Konate was obviously being groomed to replace Matip. He got injured in a mad pre-season game we played in the immediate aftermath of the Community Shield against Strasbourg, and Konate got an injury in that one. And then, you know, I think obviously Trent Alexander-Arnold's travails have been widely documented and don't need to sort of be gone into. But if the other bits of the defence and the midfield aren't functioning, the area where most teams we play choose to attack Liverpool is down that flank. So almost logically, Trent Alexander-Arnold becomes the footballer who's most exposed and ends up with the most work to do, because it has been forever thus. That is where teams have attacked Liverpool for 5 years. And the manager's made the point that we can defend like this because we've done it for 200 games. And the manager's made the point that, you know, there's a wide body of evidence that sides were already trying to do this, but they just couldn't make it work. But because other bits of the team are malfunctioning, Trent, who isn't, you know, a pure natural defender, he came through not as a defender, will therefore find it a little bit tougher. He's not Kyle Walker, and that's absolutely fine because he adds other things going forward. So all of that's added into this, and then, you know, you can go, you can keep sort of moving through. And the other part of this is that I don't think Klopp has looked to massively change the shape and tactics in the last few. Well, certainly up until, let's say hypothetically, the home game against Rangers, I don't think he's looked to change the shape and tactics enormously. I think he's been moving towards something that looks a little bit more like 4-2-4 over the course of the calendar year. But when you're suddenly, you know, picking Harvey Elliott, and that all looks a little bit more nailed on, where you can't really, you know, it now looks like not 4-3-3, but 4-2-1-3. And then that moves again. So it's now where Elliott's been playing, Diogo Jota suddenly starts to play, and that looks like 4-2-4. Then I think you sort of end up on that journey. And I don't quite, I think that they might have over-calibrated in that direction early in the campaign. And now they've just been trying to sort of recalibrate. And that's before you get to the idea of, could they have invested in another midfielder? They wanted Tchouaméni at the start of the window. Some of the players I've named within there are approaching or the wrong side of 30. So I think all of this, as I say, I don't think there's a player X has just been rubbish, which is sort of where it's felt as though firstly it turned to on Trent Alexander-Arnold. I don't think that's an analysis that makes sense. I don't think, well, you definitely should have done another midfielder. You know, you can always say you should have bought one more. And on balance, I was arguing Liverpool should have bought one more. But I don't think that becomes, you know, it's not quite as straightforward as that, because they could have bought one more and that would still not explain the way Thiago, Fabinho, Konate and Virgil van Dijk defend in their own penalty area against Arsenal for the goal that makes it 3-2. You know, these are all wonderful senior professionals who genuinely played like children for 2 minutes. And there's loads of instances over the course of the whole campaign of Liverpool's stellar players, the very, very best ones, acting like absolute idiots in split seconds. It happens practically every game. And that's why Sunday is hugely concerning, because you're coming up against a side who are brilliant at putting sides to the sword, who are playing well. Sides that will, every single half, give you two chances, two easy chances, who will act like doom brains twice in a half. That's the sort of side that City can really punish. And that's why, you know, regardless of putting seven past Rangers, Sunday's a concern.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook, you know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one. Download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal, $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep.
Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
Going into Sunday as well, you do have a lot of injury concerns, don't you?
We do, but I'm relatively relaxed about that, which some Liverpool supporters won't be. Not having Diaz is a shame because I think he's been our best player in terms of grabbing games by the scruff of the neck over the course of the season, but at least clarifies the thoughts and the options for the manager. You know, Joe Gomez does well last night against Rangers, and I really like Gomez as a player. I think he's, you know, I think he's a run of games away from showing always the sort of footballer he is. I adore him. He had a nightmare in Napoli, but then he's not the only one. And I'm fine with Gomez at right back in that, again, it clarifies Liverpool's thought processes. We haven't got one of the best playmakers on the planet playing right back. What we've got is a centre-half playing right back. So we can sort that out, and you've got to play around that, and you don't have to overcomplicate, and you need to sort of rearrange your thought process on that. Joel Matip isn't starting at centre-half. He's injured. I'd rather have started Konate for this one against Manchester City anyway, so that doesn't feel like it's the end of the world. For me, the bigger issues really are the issues around sharpness. You know, are the players who will play the game sufficiently sharp at this moment in this season to play against Manchester City? And, you know, it's almost the residual injury concerns, if you know what I mean, that I'm more concerned about than the idea of where a few of them are up to right now. You know, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's back in training, which is good news. I don't think he'll feature in this one. I'd like Curtis Jones to be around. I'd probably pick Curtis Jones if he'd had some minutes recently for this game against Manchester City in the heart of the midfield. But he isn't around, and that's a bit frustrating. But then we haven't really had him for the entirety of the season. So, you know, for me, the manager's going to have, you know, he's going to have an 11 and he's going to have five subs. Five subs that you'd be comfortable bringing on in this game at some point as it wears on. And in the round, I would like Liverpool's players to stop getting injuries. But for this one that's coming on Sunday, you know, you play the hand that you're dealt. And yeah. And I think that Liverpool having that mentality a little bit more actually is no bad thing, because I think at some sort of point, they've got to recalibrate to the reality of what this season has become for them in the league, which is about stopping the bleeding, about putting a little bit of a run together. And then from there, having an attitude of, right, let's make sure we're still in everything. And I don't mean the league title, by the way, but I certainly mean top four. Let's make sure we're still in everything by the time we get to the World Cup, because then we recalibrate, we get it sorted, and we look to have a really strong spring.
Yeah. How do you think, in terms of the weekend, how do you think the game will go? Because, like, still from my side and my experiences of City going to Anfield, Liverpool can be in as poor form as you like. It's still a very, very tough game. I'm still not expecting this to be an easy one for City at all. I think the circumstances are good for City in that they're going there at a time when Liverpool are feeling a bit down about themselves, when they don't have some key players. But equally, if Liverpool get something out of this game, if they get the 3 points, I'm not surprised. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, when we've talked about this game last couple of seasons, Dave, or certainly last season and until COVID hit, my attitude's always been with this fixture, home or away, for both sides, all three outcomes are equally likely. So, you know, I can see a world where there's a City win, I can see a world where there's a Liverpool win, I can see a world where there's a draw. And I certainly felt that way going into last season's games, you know, and in the end, City don't win any of them last season. And Liverpool sneak the semi-final win. However, that said, I don't feel that that's the case this time. You know, I feel as though we can recalibrate that a little bit and say that, you know, if we were giving Liverpool a 1-3 chance previously, I'd now maybe give Liverpool a 1-6 chance. And I'd move those chips that I've just took off Liverpool across onto Manchester City. For the reason I've said, the Arsenal game away from home is about the angriest I think I've ever been with a Liverpool team. And the reason why isn't because you got beat at Arsenal, because you can get beat at Arsenal. You can get beat at Arsenal in any season. The reason why wasn't because, you know, they shipped three goals. It was the nature and the manner of all three goals. So yeah, Liverpool,
you almost beat yourselves, didn't you?
Yeah, and Arsenal play well as well. It's not to begrudge Arsenal, but you end up in this situation where, you know, you've been conceding early in games and you go into the most ebullient stadium currently in the country with a team that are very much built on this idea of energy and belief and a real sense that there's a momentum behind them. and you concede first all the time. So surely the one thing you do is you have an attitude of let's just keep it tight for 15. And Liverpool do the absolute opposite and have conceded within 55 seconds. So all in, the problem with this is that Guardiola will describe this pre-match as his biggest domestic game of the year. He'll say it's one that we'll really see what this City side's like. City will go into it absolutely keyed up, expecting to get a barnstorming Liverpool performance. And there's every chance that for a large portion of the game, City get a barnstorming Liverpool performance. And then there's every chance that for 3 minutes across the first half or the second half, City will get a dreadful Liverpool that they will punish. So it's a really difficult game to sort of predict, because all I can do is look at what Liverpool have done over the course of this season and list you moments where either as a collective or in specific minutes, senior players, one or two of them, have been absolutely dreadful in specific split seconds. So if Liverpool manage to eradicate that, then yeah, it'll probably be like a normal Liverpool City game. But there'd be part of me, if I was Pep Guardiola, where I'd be saying, lads, let's have a really big first 10, because they've been conceding first. And then let's have a pretty patient 15 and then look to turn the screw before half time. Because in the patient 15, they might just give you a cheap one. And then when you turn the screw before half time, doubt will set in if they haven't given you a cheap one. Ultimately, before the Arsenal game, I was saying, you want a prediction from me? Listen, tell me what the scoreline is on 30 minutes and I'll give you a prediction. I'm now at the point with this one where I have to say, if you want a prediction from me, tell me what the scoreline is on 60 minutes and I'll give you the prediction. Because the Liverpool ability at the minute to shoot themselves in the foot, and I am talking about a side that won 7-1 last night, the Liverpool ability at the minute to shoot themselves in the foot is about as spectacular as I've ever seen from an excellent football team. It is remarkable. They are capable of it any time, any place, any angle. They can take their weapon and put the hole in the sole of their foot. So until that stops, Dave, I'm not going to be going into games against Manchester City with loads of confidence. What I do think will happen is Liverpool will play well in periods. They'll battle well in periods. They'll have a tactical plan that they'll execute well in periods. That is not the same as saying you can beat Manchester City at the moment.
Yeah, I tell you what, that makes me nostalgic for the 90s, though. Goodness me, I saw some City sides do some daft stuff in the 90s. Neil, I am going to ask you for a prediction. We've got the charity vet coming up a bit later on, so I need a scoreline from you. I mean, it sounds like you'll be rolling a dice to find out, but let's go for it.
Because I never want to certainly go on an opposition show and back against Liverpool, however much I've just talked the swines down there for a few minutes. The stuff in the game there that bodes well last night against Rangers, Salah finding his form. He's been playing football generally well, Salah, but he's not been getting close enough to goal and finding his form in front of goal as you'd like. So, but that he gets a hat-trick last night bodes well. Firmino is, if it wasn't for the fella who plays up front for Manchester City, Firmino would weirdly be Europe's informed centre-forward, returning goals at an Ian Rush-like rate. I will go with a 2-2 off the basis of the fact that I would hope all of your other contributors will go for a Manchester City win, and we are giving the charity the best possible chance.
Get involved with the debate on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
So that was Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap. Bob, this game is always a write-off. And yet, City are going to Anfield, where Liverpool are not in good form. Haaland is banging the goals in left, right and centre. Like, City have not had a better opportunity, have they?
Well, yeah, I agree to a certain extent. But then Liverpool go and win 7-1 last night. So, like, it's a timely confidence booster. Then Salah's re-emerged with a hat-trick after being non-existent, as far as I know, all season. So it's just really bad timing, that, isn't it? I know it's only Rangers, though. So, you know, what are Rangers in sort of English football standards? Probably like Championship at best.
I am with a Scottish man on the podcast, mate. I am not getting into this discussion of where the SPL stands.
Yeah, I was a little bit worried about that, but I've.
I would point out my bed now. I fly no flag for Rangers, quite the opposite. But they did make the Europa League final a few months ago. So, yeah, that most Championship teams wouldn't be doing that. So.
Okay.
And actually, I don't know if you ever watched the game. Rangers were actually really quite good in the first half last night, and Liverpool were really struggling until halftime. And Rangers collapsed when they went 3-1 down, and it ended up with a silly score. But that score really did not reflect most of the match. So anyway, let's not get into the SPL via Premier League debate now.
Yeah, because I mean, the cynic says to me, Bob. I don't know about you, but the cynic says to me, like, City should go to Anfield and they play their game as normal. Liverpool are struggling at the moment. City have a really good chance. So, of course, the cynic says, of course, Liverpool turn it around on Sunday, and that's where they get their win.
Yeah, that's very much my kind of outlook on football in general, particularly with this fixture. No matter what's going on with them or us, it's just all bets are off, really, I think. There's a reason we've struggled there for years, like, and I'm not sure anything's going to change this time around because there's the crowd there, which whether we like to admit it or not, it does have an impact, I think. The only difference this time, and it's such an obvious thing to say, but I'm going to say it anyway, is the Haaland factor, because he just scores so easily. And we've not had that the last couple of years, even though we've turned in some really good performances in the last two or three seasons at Anfield. So yeah. There is, I'm cautiously optimistic, but I am also pessimistic as well.
I know what you mean. Ali, I'm going to kind of put my optimist hat on, because I always say that weird things happen at Anfield and it scares me. But as Bob's just said there, City have only lost one of their last four visits there. They've won one, drawn two, but they're quietly turning their record around at Anfield.
Quietly, and it's taken a while. I think the most significant, and there's two factors. One is obviously Haaland is a huge factor, as Bob says. The other one is just how bad and in what a terrible state of disrepair Liverpool's defence is at the moment. So if you combine the Haaland factor with the Liverpool defensive chaos factor, it does put a very different perspective on what may come over the weekend. But yeah, it does feel a bit different this time. And I don't know, the two old draws that we've had. I mean, I think the game that we won was in the pandemic season, wasn't it?
Yeah, when it's behind closed doors.
Yeah, which does change it. And this is a really difficult thing to talk about, because it's almost like you're flying Liverpool's flag for them. But the Anfield factor is huge. You know, 12th man doesn't really begin to describe it. They're a very different team when they've got an Anfield crowd in kind of full voice and you know, giving it some welly behind them. So that will still be there. And I think it will be a tight game on Sunday. But I have never gone into a game with more optimism, and you know, including the last couple of years, and fingers crossed, you know, maybe this is the year that the Anfield is not quite as terrifying a place. I also think that Haaland and generally the state of their team will probably have a dampening effect on that Anfield atmosphere as well. I think Liverpool fans are absolutely dreading this match on Sunday. They're terrified of us, and they won't quite be in the same mood that they, you know, same kind of bullish mood that they usually are when we go there.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Bob, in a weird way, if what City need to do to win this game is to just slow it down. Because Liverpool like a game that's played at 100 miles an hour, and they like kind of putting pressure on teams by playing, you know, really high intensity football. So if City can get the ball, slow it down, pass it around for a bit, it quietens the crowd. But also, as we talked about earlier, they're not rushing the ball to Haaland anymore. There's a good chance of finding him in the right spaces by doing the whole link up down the flanks thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I was reading some interview with De Bruyne earlier as well, where he's alluded to that kind of need to control the game, because Liverpool are quite sort of up and down in the way they play, and very sort of emotive is the wrong word, but they kind of ebb and flow quite a lot. They can be intense for 10 minutes and then it drops off for a little bit, and they like it that way. And especially if they've got the crowd behind them, when they have got that momentum, it's quite hard to play against. So yeah, I think definitely need to try and slow it down, and I think players like Grealish would be key to that. I wouldn't want all our attackers just to be sort of the full throttle type players. So like, for example, I wouldn't want like Foden and Alvarez because they're both kind of really little, quick kind of wingers or whatever.
Yeah, get it forward quickly, run at them sort of players, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe a Grealish or Mahrez would be ideal, but as I mentioned earlier, I don't think Mahrez will play in this game. So it would be nice to see Grealish, definitely, because I think I know this is kind of, some people think it's a bit of a cop-out saying this about Grealish, but he does draw those fouls, doesn't he? And which is a great way of slowing the game down and disrupting Liverpool's flow if he is going to play. So yeah, I think that would be the key. And just sort of be patient with the build-up to Haaland, because we've got every chance if we can do that.
Yeah. Just looking at the defence, Ali, what do you think makes more sense for this one? Putting Akanji at right-back still and having Cancelo stay at left-back, or moving Ake to left-back and letting Cancelo come over to the right-hand side?
I would prefer the latter. While I accept that Gomez had a really good start to the season, I'm more worried about him defensively than I am going forward. He's great going forward. To be kind, he's still not fully tested as a defender. I think I would put it that way. And I think, despite the fact that his Premier League season at least has not been sparkling so far, I am still much more worried about Mo Salah than I am about any other Liverpool player. And the thought of putting Salah coming down their right towards our left, I would rather have Ake there as I think our strongest left-sided defender, and if that means moving Cancelo across, then go with that. So yeah, my preference would be Ake on the left, Cancelo on the right, and then whichever two, presumably Akanji and Laporte, I think are probably our best options in the middle, but whatever works. But really, I think the game will be decided in midfield and the forwards. Their attacking line will cause a degree of chaos to any defensive lineup we can put out, whether you put Ake on the left or Gomez or Cancelo or whoever else, they're still going to have Mo Salah coming at us. But if we can control the midfield and make sure that the ball just doesn't get to Mo Salah or does so as seldom as we can possibly manage, that's how we win the game. So I think, you know, the superiority now of what I hope would be Rodri, Bernardo and KDB over any midfield three, or they've actually been playing 4-2-4 effectively in recent games, Liverpool. So I don't see how they cope with that. Our defence is the least of my worries, particularly when I look at their defence.
Yeah, yeah. Right, so it was close but no cigar for recent games on the charity bet. That means we're still on £205 raised so far for the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're helping the Trussell Trust and Manchester Central Food Bank to support people who are below the poverty line in Greater Manchester. William Hill has given each of us a £10 correct score single, and our winnings are going to the group again this season. We heard earlier on that Neil from the Anfield Wrap is going for a 2-2 draw. That's 12-1 and £120 if he's right. Ali, what are you having for this one?
I'll have 1-3 to City.
3-1 City is also 12-1 and £120 if you're right. Bob, after predicting a tight game, tell us your score, mate.
Well, I did want 3-1, but that was already taken. so I've gone for a cautiously optimistic / pessimistic 4-2 to City.
4-2 to City, which would be a wild game and a wild result, because it'd be 35-1 and £350 if you're right. So I hope you're right. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change, and please gamble responsibly. For more on responsible gambling, take a look at begambleaware.org.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings.
On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Get your ears around our bonus episodes every Monday. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Now then, if you're an Instagram user, you might have found your way to an account that posts videos of old Manchester City goals. Got a hankering to see Robbie Fowler scuff in a last-minute winner against Norwich in 2005. Maybe you want to see Uwe Rosler's brave header against Lincoln in 1996. Or perhaps you've just remembered Danny Allsopp breaking clear to convert Kevin Horlock's hoof forward against Notts County in 1998. Well, they're just some of the goals that have been posted recently by Niall, the man behind the Retro City Goals account. I've been speaking to him to find out why he's decided to do it. I started by explaining how calling goals from the early noughties retro made me feel old.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm only 31 myself, and I don't think it's the best name, is it, for these goals? Because I remember these seasons really well, particularly 06-07 season. That only feels like 5 minutes ago to me as well. But yeah, I've chosen the name now. I've got to stick with it, haven't I?
Yeah, more than 15 years ago that now, isn't it? The Stuart Pearce 10 goals at home season. Yeah. So it's been a while. So guys, I mean, in terms of the goals that you pick, what makes them retro? What kind of fits the category? Are we talking pre takeover only here?
Yeah. So I debated this. Sadly, so you know, I don't waste my evenings, do I? I've debated this. I think for me, it's from more of a personal perspective, really. The first season I properly remember is 97-98, like properly with distinctive memories of that season. I've got selective memories of 96-97, really odd ones, just like Phil Neal being manager, King Cladsey, just in general, losing 3-0 away at Wolves. And I think I remember waiting what felt like an age to play Brentford in the FA Cup. So they're the things that I remember from that season. They're my proper earliest memories of City. So I'd sort of categorise City as being at the worst, I'd say. Not that season, but around that season. And then up until, you know, it acts as a bit of a bookend, I suppose, the 06-07 season where it was really bad. And I was 15-16 at the time, so I had a bit more of a sort of an informed view about football and how bad things were. But I have genuinely debated whether or not to include goals from the Sven season, but that felt like a turning point to me. I know it was a bit of a false dawn, you know, what happened after Christmas and everything, but I felt like the club turned a bit of a page in 2007. And it's one of my favourite seasons anyway, because it was just so good compared to the dross that we had for the previous 2 years, especially.
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of picking the goals, then kind of what thought goes into which ones you pick? Because like is it just a case of anything and everything that City have scored in the past? Because there are some goals on there that I've watched them and I've thought that was not a tidy goal. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, yeah. There's no glamour in it. it's literally. I'm making myself out to be right, sad away, but I've got a spreadsheet because when I started doing it, I didn't think it'd take off, to be honest with you. It was just, I look back and I think I started in 2019, so I can't even blame COVID for it, but I think COVID spurred me on to do it because I was just bored out of my mind. But there's no rhyme or reason to what goals I pick. I just want to try and get everyone on there, I think. There's a few goals that I'm missing, which I can't find, but there is no science behind it. It's literally, right, I've not got that one on there yet, so I'm going to pick that, you know, Lee Bradbury's header against Stoke. I don't think anybody wants to see it, but it's going on. So yeah, I think that there's a few, if I remember rightly, there's a few accounts, I think, on Instagram and Twitter that put goals up of City, you know, games of years gone by. But it's generally sort of themed. So, you know, if we're playing Newcastle at the weekend, it'll be goals we scored against Newcastle. And they're far better than mine, the quality, and they're really good at running them. But for me, it's just, you know, there's a very sort of specific feeling about that era for me, from 96 to 2007.
Yeah, I feel it.
Yeah, I don't long for it. I don't miss it necessarily. I think I was quite blessed to be young, so I didn't understand just how shit we were up until sort of turning 16 and Stuart Pearce gave me a couple of years of that. So, yeah, it's literally just a hobby for me, and putting goals up that, you know, I've not seen. And it sort of goes back to when I was, I don't know, from about 8 year old onwards, every Christmas it was just, I'd get the season review DVD or video. That was the annual Christmas present for me. And then for whatever reason, from about 2003 onwards, whoever produced the DVDs at City just cut out random goals. So if we'd been beaten 3-1, the goal that we'd scored wouldn't be on the DVD. And to a lot of people, even to me at the time, it didn't really matter. But looking back, there's a few goals from my childhood that I've never seen. I think, you know, there's a couple from the year we got relegated from the Premier League in 2001. I've never seen them and I can't find them. And it's just become a bit of an obsession now trying to get them. So, yeah, it's sort of turned into, you know, it doesn't take up much of my time, but it's good to see that people are enjoying it. And I've had people contact me as well saying, you know, I think Dalian Atkinson goal against Stoke in 97, that was, you know, some lad contacted me and said that was the first goal we'd ever seen and he'd never seen it before. So it's just nice to put them up, and people have a lot of memories, don't they, that are, you know, quite close to them.
Amazing. Have any of the players that have scored them been in touch and interacted with you?
Yeah. Paolo Wanchope liked a lot of them, which was a bit surreal because he was one of my favourite players. So I don't think he follows me though, but, you know, I can't have everything. Jim Whitley follows the account, and I think he commented on a goal that he scored against Notts County in the League Cup, and I don't think he'd seen it, so that was quite nice. There were a couple of other players that have commented. I think Lee Peacock got in contact, even though he'd never scored for us. I think he'd been tagged in one of the goals he'd set up, or a picture that I'd put up or something. So yeah, there's quite a few, and it's weird because these are the players that I grew up with and had a lot of time for. They were like, you know, at 8 year old, 9 year old, you don't know any better. And the sort of your heroes that you know, looking back, they were just League One Championship players compared to what we've got now. But yeah, it's really nice, isn't it? Just to interact with ex City players. And yeah, as I said, I think Jim Whitley's the main one that follows the account. Wanchope, that was my favourite one. That when I saw that he'd shared some of the goals on his story. So, yeah, I might have a bit of a following in Costa Rica, unbeknownst to me.
Yeah, that would be great. What's the feeling like then? Because like I'm not going to brand it as sad, because I've done exactly the same thing throughout my life of collecting City goals and rewatching them and stuff like that. But you're right, there are goals that you can't find and goals that you can't see. So what's that feeling like when suddenly you stumble across a YouTube video and there it is, there's a goal that you didn't know existed on the internet?
Yeah, there is a sense of achievement, which, you know, I'm not proud of. There is a sense of achievement when I find one, and I will probably text my brother. My brother's 25, I think, 26, so he's a few years younger than me. And there was one goal in particular. I think it was Andy Cole scored against Wigan in the FA Cup. It's not a good goal. It's not a memorable game. It's not a memorable season, but I think my brother was at an age when that DVD came out, similar to what I was, about 10-year-old, and he'd never seen the goal back. So he's been looking for that goal for the best part of 2 years, and I think he found it for me. And that was particularly amusing. Yeah, again, I don't know who's got any fondness for Andy Cole's goal against Wigan in the fourth round of the FA Cup in 2006. I don't know who's been gatekeeping it as well, because it was on Daily Motion in really poor quality. So, yeah, it's always nice when I find one. Another one for me, I think Jeff Whitley scored against Everton away at Goodison. I have no memory of that game. And I think City got battered 3-1, 4-1. And that was particularly amusing to find that goal.
I was at that game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I cried at the end of it because that was the game I realised City were going down.
That brought back some memories when I put that up then.
Yeah. That's the thing as well. It's like anyone who listens to the podcast regularly knows that I love a good bout of nostalgia, and my nostalgia era is exactly this era. So your account speaks entirely to me. What's the response been to it?
Really good, I think. Really good. I've not had anybody, other than myself, call me sad, but they're probably not doing that to my face, are they? So yeah, it's been really positive. I think that I get quite a lot of interaction from City fans on there. Randomly get a few sort of opposition fans piping up now and again, which is nice. But yeah, I think it's positive. I think everyone's got that view, really. Like I said before, I don't think anybody longs for those days again. But there's a certain appreciation for them, for City fans of a certain age. And as I said, I don't think we miss them, but we can appreciate just how bad we were. And when we were good in that era, we really did enjoy it. Thinking of like the Keegan season. And for me, I know it's not the best season in our history because we were at our lowest point, but that year we got promoted and beat Gillingham. That was like my first proper season as a City fan. I know I've got massive memories of 97, 98, which is even worse, but I was lucky to be, 6, 7, 8 year old at the time. So I didn't fully comprehend just how bad things had got. So yeah, it's really positive, really positive.
Yeah. Are there any goals that you're missing that you're absolutely desperate to get your hands on? And I'm thinking if anybody listening to this might have them, then we can maybe put out an appeal for them.
Oh, yeah. So I think I bet if anyone's got these, God bless you. There's two goals against Wimbledon in the League Cup in 2000, which I cannot find for love nor money. I think one chop and go to score. And then there's a goal against Villa from the same season, which I think Goethe scores at home when we get beat, and Dion Dublin and Paul Merson, I think, have the games of their life. And then there's one particular game. I think I've got all of Lee Bradbury's goals for City. I think I'm the only place in the world you can go to and find and watch all of Lee Bradbury's goals for City. But there's a game from 97-98 against Huddersfield away, and I think City win 3-0 or 3-1. And I can't find any of those goals. So they're the main ones. And then the last one, to round off the greatest season in our history in 2006-2007, I'm missing Samaras's penalty away at Chesterfield. So if anybody's got that, get in touch and I can complete the collection. It's not a very big one, as you can imagine, from 2006-2007. But yeah, just need Samaras's penalty, I think, to complete that.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
So that was Niall from Retro City Goals on Instagram. Go and give it a follow. It's great fun. Plenty of old City goals to watch on there. You can waste a good few hours just scrolling through the feed. It got me thinking, this one, about kind of pre-takeover goals. So I'm gonna start off first off by asking you for a nomination for your favourite pre-takeover City goal. Ali, have you got any that immediately spring to mind?
I could pick any one of about a dozen different kinky goals. Georgi Kinkladze is probably the first City player that I properly fell in love with. But of all of them, I had to go back and use this as an excuse to spend about another hour watching Kinkladze clips on YouTube last night. And the little dink against Southampton is, I think, the pinnacle. It was just such a glorious, wonderful dribble, and just the elegance, the balance, the cheek of it was just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, all left foot as well. No point did Southampton go. We should probably get him off his left foot. Bob, any for you?
Well, I was thinking that same goal, actually, funnily enough. I was watching it again this morning, and it is hilarious, like, how bad the defending is. So, like, which, when I was a little boy, like, playing football at primary school every single day, I just didn't think that. Thought it was just incredible, but it's just laughably bad how poor the defending is. And I love after he's passed the last defender, he takes about 8 little steps before he chips it. Like, but he only travels about half a meter. It's just, it's really weird to look at.
He only did have little legs, though, to be fair.
That is true.
That is true, yeah.
I nominated Niklas Jensen against Leeds for this one because, like, genuinely, completely, like, possibly even still to this day, the best goal I've ever seen. Just completely unexpected from a volley on the left-hand side. It got me out of my seat, that one, and it was one that that I remember. I remember jumping up from my seat at Main Road and shouting, "What a goal!" when that left his foot. Are there any for you, Bob, that you think of when that you saw live that you were like, "I have just seen a wonderful goal"?
The first one that came to mind immediately was the Alano free kick against Newcastle. I think it was in 2007. Just an unbelievable goal. I think we won 3-1. I think that day, and it was like in the 90th minute. And that free kick, I've never seen a free kick like it before or since. It just didn't seem to curl. It was just perfectly straight into the top left-hand corner. And it was seemed about 30 yards out. And at that point, like in the context of Sporting City, like coming off 2 years, the back of 2 years of Stuart Pearce, to see something that incredible live was just really special. So yeah, that's easily my choice.
You say that. The two that I've nominated for best goals that I've seen live that isn't Niklas Jensen both came in the Pearce era. I was at the FA Cup game against Preston because Preston was my university town or city. And so I went to that FA Cup game, and Michael Ball's opener was a brilliant goal. He smashed it in from the edge of the box in off the post. After Bernardo Corradi had kind of done this weird flick on the edge of the box and then volleyed it into the far corner, but it hit the post and come back out. And then later on in that game, Stephen Ireland scored a volley that was... Nicky Weaver took a free kick from midway in the City half, and the ball did not touch the ground from going from Weaver's foot to the back of the Preston net. Weaver hoofed it long. Samaras headed it inside. Karadi took two touches, like headed it up and then volleyed it across. And then Ireland volleys it into the bottom corner. It's a fantastic goal that does not do that team just did not deserve to score, if you know what I mean.
they were both incredible, those. I remember that game really distinctly as well, because it was one of the few times at that like few years where City were on BBC, which was really rare. And so, yeah, those goals were absolute screamers. So I think they're good choices, Mooney.
Yeah. Ali, any for you that you were there to see?
Yeah, well, I'll go back to, I think it was only my second ever City game. For the historical detail, I moved to Manchester in the October 1992. In fact, exactly, almost to the day, it would have been 30 years ago today that I moved to Manchester. So there you go. But I moved to Rusholme, literally about 150 yards from Main Road, and went to a couple of games in my first few months down there. And I think the second one was the FA Cup match against Spurs, which ended up 4-2 to them.
Yeah.
But our
I know what's coming, don't you?
Yeah. Our second goal. When Terry Phelan picked up the ball in his own half in a lot of space and just took off. We were talking about the defending for Kinky's goal against Southampton. Well, go back and look at this one again, because like, it makes those Southampton defenders look positively accomplished. But he just marched. That's the wrong word. He glided right through right along the pitch, took out, I counted, 6 different Spurs players, 3 of which were within about 2 yards of each other around the 18-yard line, and he just went straight through them and slotted it perfectly into the corner. And it was a remarkable goal. It was particularly remarkable because I had gone along, wasn't even really a City fan. I was there with a West Ham fan who had got the tickets from a friend who was a Spurs fan. And so we were somewhere around the Spurs fans. And then shortly after the Terry Fielding scored his goal, there was a pitch invasion from City fans from the Kippax first, I think. And then some Spurs fans started going on and it all started kicking off. And this was still, you know, the days of Heysel and Hillsborough and stuff were fairly fresh memories then. And me and my mate just kind of turned, looked at each other, was like, nope, we're out of here. Shortly after the feeling goal, we just headed for the exit and headed for the nearest pub. So I never did see the final whistle. Thankfully, the scenes on the pitch were died down fairly quickly, and I don't think anyone actually did get hurt. But it was certainly a memorable way to begin going watching Manchester City.
Yeah, definitely. To finish your first game with the sight of a police horse pissing all over the penalty area. And,
exactly.
Yeah, quite the memory. Any Ali for you that players that very rarely scored that the ones who went, goodness me, he's scored. I can't believe it.
At the time, not particularly. When I was thinking about your question, I guess I was surprised because it was in his debut, but a goal that absolutely will always stick in my mind was Michael Richards' debut goal against Villa in what would have been 2006, I think, probably.
Let's be honest, mate. Nobody remembers the goal.
You absolutely know what's coming, don't you? I will mention it because I did look again. It was an absolutely cracking bullet header, made better because David James had been doing a very David James thing and had gone marching up for the final corner of the game. And the ball just flew an inch over David James's head, and Micah just connected absolutely four square, and it flew into the corner, absolutely cracking bullet header. And then, of course, the really memorable thing was his debut interview after, and it did make me laugh a little while ago when he was on one of the Five Live Monday night clubs or whatever, and he was talking about all the media training he'd had as a young player. And I was like, mate, the very first thing you did with a camera go point was drop an F-bomb on live TV. Bless him, his media career has gone from strength to strength since then. That was a great goal from an unlikely source.
Yeah, two for me that stood out on this one were I nominated Gerard Vikings at Stoke because City were down in the 30, they needed to win, and they went away to Stoke. And a corner came in, and I remember Vikings, the ball seemed to hang in the air for an age, and I think he headed it up to himself and then volleyed it into the top corner. Brilliant finish. And the other one, just because he was a midfielder, but someone who kind of... You maybe expect to score more than he did. Go and look it up on YouTube because it is still there. Ian Bishop scoring in an FA Cup tie against Leeds. Most memorable for me because Andy Gray says of him, we know this about Ian Bishop. He has got lovely feet. And the way he says it makes it sound like he's some sort of foot fetishist rather than a co-commentator. But it's like the goal, it does not detract from the goal at all. Any for you, Bob?
The one that stands out for me is Sylvain Distan versus Villa. I think it was in 2006, where he basically just runs the length of the pitch and scores. I love it how he basically brings it out of his own box, plays a 1-2. I don't know who with, but once he receives the ball back, he's just inside the opposition's half.
And he's clean through, isn't he?
Pretty much, yeah. He only takes three more touches. Like, there's one that goes about a meter in front of him, and then the next one he just boots it forward. It's like he knew he had the pace on the defender and the strength, and he just breezes past the defender. Then the third touch is the finish. It's amazing.
There's always one prick, isn't there, in the schoolyard who's quicker than everybody else, who just gets it and boots it as far as they can because they know they'll get there first. That's just what it made me think of.
I have to admit, that was me, mate. That's the only thing I can do in a football pitch.
Yeah, I can chase it, but don't expect me to do anything else. Don't know what will happen when I get there. The final one I wanted to ask about, and I genuinely haven't got an answer to this, and I wonder if it's partly because I do so many things about City nostalgia in the noughties that I don't forget players. But favourite goal by a player that you'd forgotten about until I asked you to look at these old retro goals. Does anybody have anything to stand out on this one?
It's not a player that I'd say I forget about, but it's definitely a goal that I'd forgotten about and probably a goal that is too easily forgotten about. We talk a lot about the goals that changed Manchester City's history in the playoffs, particularly. I mean, talk about the Gillingham goals or the penalty shootouts and all the rest of it, on the basis that if those goals hadn't been scored, everything that happened after would never have happened, you know, the takeover and you know, our recent history. Well, there was another one. It was in 2004 when we had a match against Newcastle when they were going for Champions League, I think, and we needed 1 point or maybe 2 points to avoid relegation in 2004. Had we gone down, then everything that happened after we'd probably never have seen. Anyway, a player that gets too little credit in the history of the City annals, Paolo Wanchope. Yes. Always loved Paolo Wanchope, playing alongside Anelka. And he kind of bent down and stooped really low, about 18 yards out, and scored an absolutely screaming header, beautiful header, really difficult technique. And we won the game 1-0 and City stayed up. And if it hadn't been for that goal, you know, everything that has happened to us since may well not have happened. So a goal, if not a player that's too often forgotten, a goal that is too often forgotten, take a bow, Paolo Wanchope.
Yeah, Bob. Anything to add to that one? I will also accept goals that people forgot rather than players that people forgot.
Well, I had to really think hard about this because I was looking through the Retro City Goals account just to aid my memory a bit because I have a bit of a weird blackout about the early noughties. From about 2001 to about 2004, I just really struggled to remember anything about it. But yeah, the one I came across, which I thought that's a really good goal. But just it's so insignificant, is Hatem Trabelsi against United when we lost 3-1.
Oh, God, wow. I will have that. Yeah, I'll have that one. Yeah,
that absolutely the brief.
It was a really good goal, but we were losing 2-0 at that point, and I think he scored in about the 82nd minute. Left foot from the edge of the box. I think it hits the bar on the way in. Keeper had no chance. A lovely finish, but we went on to lose 3-1, and I mean, I just don't remember anything else about that game at all.
Yeah, I'll take it because I had completely forgotten. He's possibly the only player that I'd completely forgotten about in this that had scored in that time. Yeah, what a shout. What an absolute shout that is. Right, well, that brings this week's Blue Moon podcast to an end. Thank you very much to my guests, Ali Fogg.
Absolute pleasure.
And Bob Toole.
Cheers, Mooney.
There's a clip of this week's Patreon bonus show coming up. I'll be back next week to review whatever happens at Anfield. So join me then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
There was a guy outside the stadium and he was selling these little pin badges and it said MCFC crest. And it says promoted 1989. And I thought, it's a bit premature, but okay, I'll buy one. In the ground, he saw I was right up at the back of the stand, right on, literally ahead, his inches of the roof. And it was one of those games, it was a really warm day. And that Bradford only had, I think, two attempts, one went in, and we was just literally all over them. The pitch with the ball was bobbling, it was a really rough pitch. And I think we hit the woodwork two or three times, and the keeper was and the defenders were blocking everything. I've learned all this subsequently, that once a defender had a radio on him and ran onto the field and sort of grabbed Paul Blake to tell him that Palace were winning 4-0 and they just got to half time. And when David White did get past their centre back and squared it, Trevor Moore to score, it was to coin the phrase here like these days, in the Tevison, it was proper limbs.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast and join us again next time for another episode.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Hey, this is Steve Gorman, radio host, sports commentator, former drummer for the Black Crowes. The winter holidays are here, a time for festive celebrations, family gatherings, and ringing in the new year. Whether it's a holiday party, a night out with friends, or just relaxing by the fire with a few drinks, it's a season full of good cheer. But here's something else to add to your holiday plans, a safe and sober ride home. Just like in sports and music, always have a game plan. And the most important part of any plan is sticking to it. If you plan to drink, take that plan a step further. Call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or have a designated driver lined up before the night begins. Drinking and driving is a decision that can change your life and the lives of others forever. A DUI, a crash, an injury, the consequences are real and lasting. So please, for your sake and for everyone else on the road, make the smart choice. Get a sober ride home. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by NHTSA.